Om namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Over the next four evenings, we're going to do a survey of the first chapter of Lord Kapiladeva's instructions to his mother Devahuti on the science of pure devotional service. So we're working out of chapter 25 of the third canto of Srimad Bhagavatam, and we'll cover the instructions that the Lord gives in that chapter. This will involve discussing several verses each evening, which doesn't leave us time. For one thing, we won't have time to read Srila Prabhupada's purports on these verses. So if you have any time during the day, if you have a copy of this volume, then you can take it as your homework assignment to read the text with Prabhupada's purports. So to cover what we are doing tonight and tomorrow night, your homework assignment can be from verses 13 to verse 27 in this chapter 25. Read the text and especially read Prabhupada's purports. So we're going to only cover the verses that give the actual instructions, not the introductory verses. That's why we're starting from verse 13. And not even the verses where Mother Devahuti is asking her questions. We'll skip over those verses. We're starting from verse 13. And to save time, we won't repeat the verse. I'll just chant it myself. Shri Bhagavan Uvacha. Don't repeat. Yoga Adhyatmikak Pumsam Mato Nikshayasaya Me Atyanto Paratir Yatra Dukasya Chasukasya Cha. The personality of Godhead said, this is Lord Kapila, the son of Kardama, and Devahuti speaking. The yoga system which relates to the Lord and the individual soul, which is meant for the ultimate benefit of the living entity, and which causes detachment from all happiness and distress in the material world, is the highest yoga system. So Kapiladeva begins his instructions talking in general terms. And then he will become more specific as he goes on. More specific, particularly, in that he will emphasize more and more the importance of devotional service to the personality of Godhead. But in the first few verses, he's talking in general terms about self-realization. Now this follows the pattern that you find in the Vedas and in Vedic literature, including the Puranas, that because most people are absorbed in material work and they don't have much capacity to understand transcendental knowledge, nor do they have much interest, the Vedas begin by emphasizing the karmakanda, the ritualistic portion that teaches us how to work in an auspicious way, to dedicate the fruit of our work to the Supreme, to work in such a way that we become purified. And for those who graduate that course, There is the Gyanakanda, the section of the Vedas that teaches higher knowledge, particularly knowledge of our actual spiritual identity. How do you graduate the course? What are you supposed to know? What are you supposed to learn from the course of karma, of fruitive work? Pariksha lokan, karma chitan, nivedamayad, nastya kritak kritena. After experiencing and thinking carefully about the value of material life and the success that you can attain in material life, nirvedamayat. One who's gotten actual experience and realization of what is actually going on should lose interest in that material life. A successful karmi is one who becomes dissatisfied with material life. That's the lesson to learn from our material entanglement, that it's suffering, or as explained elsewhere, that the success you can attain through material work, whatever it is, it's temporary and it's very limited. We have different ideas, all of us, about what we think is material success. But in general, it cannot, your happiness, your success cannot last forever. And it is relative to what can be attained otherwise from the higher endeavors of spiritual life. It is very inferior. So someone should become indifferent to it and therefore turn, if he's intelligent enough, to the path of transcendental knowledge. In that Gyanakanda, we learn about our spiritual identity in general terms. And this is taught especially in the Upanishads, the path of Jnana, of knowledge, spiritual knowledge. And we find in the Upanishads not so much emphasis on the distinction between the finite soul, us, the individual souls, and the Supreme Soul. That is not so much the focus in the Gyanakanda. Sometimes it is pointed out, sometimes it's ignored, and sometimes it's presented as if there was no difference between the small soul and the big soul. The emphasis is that we are spiritual. Our nature is Sat-Chit-Ananda, eternal, conscious, and blissful by our nature. So that is our nature, and is the nature of God also. That is what we learn in the Gyanakanda. It is general knowledge. The graduates, those who graduate from that course, can enter the course of bhakti, of devotion, where we learn that, yes, we are all spirit, but there is one supreme spirit. Eko bahunam yo vidadati kaman. This is taught in the Shvetashvatara Upanishad. Nityo nityanam chetanas chetananam. Kato Upanishad. Nityo nityanam chetanas chetananam. Eko bahunam yo vidadati kaman. There are many eternal souls, but there is one special eternal among all the other eternal living beings. All the living beings are conscious, but there's one person whose consciousness is supreme, who knows everything. And his special distinguishing feature, characteristic, Eko Bahunam, he's the one who supplies the desires and necessities of all the others. That is the Supreme Lord. So that is the Bhakti Kanda, the highest understanding. Kapiladev, so the Vedas start off by teaching us the path of karma. Then if we can pass that course, we enter the course of Jnana. And those who are the graduates of that course can enter the super graduate course of Bhakti Yoga. Kapila Devi's intention here is to teach his mother Bhakti Yoga. But he also follows the general procedure of beginning with the preliminaries. So he begins by teaching general jnana. His mother has already acknowledged in the question she asked that she said, I am disgusted with this material entanglement. Please enlighten me with transcendental knowledge so I can become free. Hearing this, Kapiladeva understands his mother doesn't need to be told about karma, about the glories of karma and how to go about fruitive activity. She's already had enough of that. She's ready to enter the course of jnana. So Kapiladeva makes a very quick survey of basic transcendental knowledge about the spiritual nature of the soul before he enters into the higher understanding of the soul's relationship with his creator and the loving devotional service that is the real purpose of life. That he'll begin speaking about tomorrow. Today we'll discuss the preliminary verses. And beginning with verse 20, Lord Kapiladeva actually gets into the topic of devotional service. Here he says that the highest yoga process, there is karma yoga also, the yoga of dovetailing the fruits of your work for the pleasure of the Supreme. But the higher and yoga is what is called adhyatmika, spiritual. Karma yoga itself is not, by our acharyas, like Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, is not considered an actually spiritual activity. Simply working according to the Vedic prescriptions, performing sacrifice, is not in itself spiritual. If you still maintain selfish material desires, then you're not a spiritualist. You're just a materialist, even if you're pious. When one goes beyond that and can perform nishkama karma yoga, work without material motives, with selflessly, then that's the beginning of spiritual life. But higher than that is adhyatmika yoga. Mato nikshraya sayame. In my opinion, Kapiladeva is saying, this is what leads to the perfection of life. Working according to the karma kanda, performing your duty, is only preliminary. It helps purify you so you become ready to receive transcendental knowledge. But in itself, it's not spiritual. So when someone quotes from the Bhagavad Gita in defense of his material entanglement, karma nye vadikaras te, maapaleshu kadachana, someone will propound that that is his religion. That Krishna says, you have a right to do your duty, but you can't be attached to the fruits, and that's perfection. It is not perfection. Yes, you have to do your duty, and you should not be attached to the fruits, but that is not in itself spiritual. You take that one verse of the Gita out of context, it is an excuse for materialism. Look at the next chapter, that's the third chapter. Look in the fourth chapter, where Krishna says, yagyartat karmano anyatra loko yam karma bandana. You must work for the Supreme Lord, for yajna, sacrifice, for the pleasure of the Supreme. Not just sacrificing for your family, for your country. You must sacrifice for the Supreme Lord. Otherwise, loko yam karma bandana. This world is just a place of bondage for you. There will be no liberation. There is no progress in spiritual life unless we dedicate our work to the Supreme. So this is what Kapiladeva is beginning with. Atyanto paratir. Uparati means stopping. Stopping obsession with material goals. Stopping our frenetic activity, feverish activity for material success. Put that aside. And there is the cessation, the symptom, the success of this yoga is that atyanto paratir sukhasya cha dukhasya cha. There is the cessation of material unhappiness and material happiness. Of course, no one wants unhappiness, but it comes without our wanting it. People want material happiness, but they don't realize that it's also misery. It's the cause of their misery. That they're pursuing sense gratification is the cause of their unhappiness. So, to be a yogi means to give up both material, to become free from material pain and pleasure. Okay, so we'll read the next verse. Kapila Dev goes on.
Tamimam te pravakshyami yamavocham puranage Vishinam shotukamanam yogam sarvam danaipunam.
O most pious mother, I shall now explain unto you the ancient yoga system which I explained formerly to the great sages. It is serviceable and practicable in every way. In the purport, Srila Prabhupada explains that it's not that some new system has to be concocted. Even the Supreme Lord himself, who can make up a new system if he wants, he can create a new universe if he wants, but he chooses not to. He says here, I'm going to speak to you, nothing new, the same system of yoga that I previously taught to the great sages in past ages, in the ancient times. Yogam sarvanga nipunam. Nipuna means expert. So this is a nipuna is the word derived from that. This yoga system is very effective. Don't expect that you'll waste a lot of time and any more effort than is necessary. This is a streamlined process. In fact, Kapila Dev is going to explain the whole karma Gyanakanda in seven verses to his mother. How long does it take to speak seven verses? Anushtup. 32 syllable verse. Half a minute for each verse. So in 3.5 minutes, he can speak the whole science of transcendental knowledge to his mother. And then move on to devotional service. We're stretching it out a little bit with explanation, but we'll cover it in less than an hour. Two points, that the system is nothing new. If the Supreme Lord doesn't need to concoct anything, then certainly a mere mortal who's claiming to be a teacher of the science of spiritual life should also not be making things up, but should simply repeat what has been established by previous authorities, by the Shastra, by the Acharyas in the disciplic succession, and originally by the Supreme Lord himself. Okay, the next verse, where he actually begins his discussion of what consists of transcendental knowledge.
Chetan kalu asya bandaya muktaye chatmano matam guneshu saptam bandaya ratam va pumsi muktaye. The stage in which the consciousness of the living entity is attracted by the three modes of material nature is called conditional life. But when that same consciousness
is attached
to the Supreme Personality of Godhead. One is situated in the consciousness of liberation.
So he has already snuck in the idea of service to the Supreme Lord. Pumsi, person. It's the word Puman, person, same synonym with the word Purusha.
So someone may wonder, well, the word Purusha can just mean man or person. Why does it necessarily mean the Supreme Person? But in this context, it can't mean anything else. He's saying here that the mind can be both the cause of bondage and the cause of freedom, your own mind, depending how you use it, can ruin you or save you. And then he specifies, guneshu saktam. If your mind is attached to the material modes, if you are addicted to material pleasure and material success, bandhaya, that is the cause of bondage, of entanglement and suffering. But if it's attached to Puman, the Supreme Person, then it leads to liberation, mukti. So, even though it doesn't say here, Supreme Person, literally, it just says person, it should be obvious that attachment to an ordinary person isn't going to give liberation. That's in the category of being materially attached. So, logically, it has to mean Supreme Person, even though it's not explicitly stated. Therefore, Prabhupada is justified in taking the liberty in his translation here to say Personality of Godhead, even though the Sanskrit word is simply Puman, person. It's obviously the Supreme Person. So actually here he's giving, even at the very beginning, the seed idea behind the science of devotional service. As I quoted the other verse, work has to be performed for the satisfaction of yajna. That's again the Hindustani pronunciation. Yajna.
Okay, sacrifice.
In the Shatapatha Brahmana, in the very beginning, it is stated, Yajyo vai Vishnuhu. The sacrifice is Vishnu. Not literally, but it is Vishnu because it's all meant for the pleasure of Vishnu. That's what sacrifice means. Work that is done for the pleasure of the Supreme is, by definition, yajna, sacrifice. And other work, you can call it what you want. You can call it sacrifice. I'm sacrificing for my family. I'm sacrificing for the corporation I work for. But that's not real. That doesn't fit the definition that the Shastra gives. Therefore, Krishna says that in the Gita, that if you don't work for the pleasure of the Supreme, your work is a cause of bondage. And Krishna also says elsewhere in the Gita, the mind is the friend. Bandhuratmatmanastasya, the verse before that. No, this is sixth chapter. Anyway, Bandhuratmatmanastasya, yenaitma atmaivatmana jitaha. The mind, your intelligence, your mind is your best friend or your best enemy. If you can control your intelligence, then the intelligence. If you, the soul, controls the intelligence, and then the intelligence controls the mind, then the mind is your best friend, if it's kept under control. But if it's the other way around, if the mind controls your intelligence, whatever you see, you see an ice cream cone in an advertisement, I have to get an ice cream cone. Your mind is controlling your intelligence. You see something,
You can't help but be attracted to it, and then you have to make plans to obtain it. You know, you see a beautiful member of the opposite sex, and you have to conspire how to obtain that enjoyable person. This is the mind in control of intelligence, and the control and intelligence controlling the self, upside down, backwards. That is the cause of bondage, the mind out of control. Or as Patanjali Rishi in his Yoga Shastra, Yoga Sutras, he says, Yoga Indriya Samyamaha. The definition of what yoga is learning how to control your senses. And ultimately it means to control the mind. Who's supposed to be controlling the senses? So Kapila Devi is simply pointing out that general principle of yoga, that the mind must be brought under control. Then your own mind will be the cause of your liberation. Otherwise, it will drag you down into materialism. Okay, we'll go on to verse 16.
Aham mama bimanottai kama loba dibir malai vitam yadamanat shudham adukam asukam samam. When one is completely cleansed of the impurities of lust and greed produced from the false identification of the body as I, and bodily possessions as mine, one's mind becomes purified. In that pure state, he transcends the stage of so-called material happiness and distress. So this is, in very short summary, the practice of yoga. One should aim at giving up the contamination of the mind, lust, envy, and greed. Trividam narakasyedam dwaram nashanam atmanaha kamo lobas tata krodha tasmari taptrayam jajit, Krishna says in the Gita. There are three doorways to hell, and they are present in your own mind. These three are lust, envy, and greed. Therefore, you should strive to give them up. Then the mind can be brought under control. Aham mama bimano tai, Kapiladev here says. Kama loba adibir. Kama, loba, lust, greed, and then you can add adi, etc. You can add more onto the list. Lust, envy, greed. Jai Shri Jagannath, Shri Gorni Tai. Maliciousness, cheating, jealousy, all the vices that can invade the mind. Unlimited list. Beginning with kama and loba. Lust, desire for selfish sense gratification in various forms, and loba, greed, avarice. Where do they come from? Aham mama. From the sense of I and mine. From the selfish identification that I am the center of existence. Everything around me belongs to me. I am the controller. I am the enjoyer. This is the egotistic material consciousness. So because of that basic selfish materialistic attitude, one develops all these bad emotions of lust, envy, and so on. If by some means or other you can rid yourself of these contaminations, then your mind becomes purified. Equipoised, samam.
Our problem is that we look at the world around us, and some things attract us and some things repel us. That is the function of the mind, to be attracted and repelled. Those functions can be good for us. If there's a fire within reach, I should be repelled from the idea of sticking my hand in the fire. That is proper use of the mind. I don't want to be burned. So therefore, I don't just, out of curiosity, put my hand in the fire. And if I put my hand in the fire, I will feel intense pain. And my nervous system will tell me what I couldn't figure out for myself, that you don't want to do this. You don't want to put your hand in the fire. It hurts. So the proper use of the mind in being repelled by some things and attracted to others is useful. It's actually necessary for survival in this world. We have to choose what to accept and what to reject. Otherwise, we will kill ourselves very quickly. But the misuse of it is the cause of confusion and suffering. So, we look around us, especially if we look at other people, and we put labels on them. He's my friend, he's my enemy. He's a good person, he's a bad person. But we judge from a selfish point of view. Because this person is helping me gain sense gratification, helping me become successful in my plans, he's a good person, I like him. And this next person, because he's obstructing my endeavors, giving me a hard time, he's bad, he's my enemy. We judge people from our own selfish point of view, according to how they promote the aim of our own sense gratification. This is not intelligent. This is how we get into trouble. So Kapila Deva is giving very practical instruction here, that when the mind can be freed, can become purified by simply becoming freed from these inappropriate feelings, lust, envy, and greed, we can see things clearly, and then we become free from material happiness and material distress. Then we are samam, equipoised. It's general explanation of spiritual progress. The details will be filled in soon, but this is a general characterization. Next verse.
Tada purusha atmanam kevalam pratvitek param nirantaram swayam jyotir animanam akanditam.
So when the mind is purified and comes into good working order, when it becomes your friend, then you can realize who you actually are. This is what we call self-realization. So spiritual life is the process of self-realization. It means to know, to learn who you are. It's not some artificial endeavor to become something other than what you are. It's not artificial, unnatural. It's the most natural thing, because it means to find out what you actually are. Not to change you, but to uncover your real identity. That is self-realization. That comes from jnana. Working for sacrifice, karma yoga, is preliminary. It purifies you enough so you can begin learning this transcendental knowledge. The knowledge itself purifies you to the point you can begin to understand who you really are. And Kapila Deva is giving an outline of that spiritual identity of the self here in this verse. Then, that means when the person becomes purified from lust, envy, and greed, equipoised and free from the disturbances of material happiness and distress, then he realizes himself, atmanam. And how does he realize himself? What does he realize about himself? That he has the following basic characteristics. Kevalam, pure spirit. Now, these words are, from the dictionary, we could pick out different meanings of these words, but we have to see the meaning in the context. And the Acharyas, who have written their commentaries on Srimad Bhagavatam, help us in understanding these definitions. Which meaning of the word, these words all have more than one meaning, which meaning is appropriate in this particular context? The Vaishnavacharyas give us their opinion on this. And Srila Prabhupada, when he wrote his purports to Srimad Bhagavatam, he consulted these commentaries and repeated for us in our own language how to understand these words properly. So Kevalam means exclusive, but here it means exclusively spiritual, pure spirit. Our identity, first of all, we're not something of this material world. We're not a creation of matter. We're a spiritual entity. Spiritual means sat, chit, ananda. We are eternal. Matter is not eternal. Matter, everything material is temporary. But we are eternal spiritual entities. Matter is inert. It has no consciousness. It is not aware of itself or of anything else. But we are conscious of ourselves and also conscious of other things that we perceive. And we can be conscious of the Supreme also. Proof. How can we say that we are conscious of our own self? Just look at the way that anybody speaks. I see the fan rotating. Okay, I'm conscious of the fan. But what's the first word in that sentence? I. So the first thing that we're conscious of is ourself. That's expressed in our normal day-to-day language. I'm talking about the fan, but I can't help mentioning I see the fan. The first thing that everybody is aware of is his own self. Kevalam. So we are pure spirit. We're not dead matter. We're not some temporary thing that will go out of existence. We are eternal. And our inseparable quality is that we are living consciousness. And the third quality, ananda. Our real purpose in existing is to experience happiness. And this is also proven in everybody's experience. No matter what you are, you may be an atheist, you may be a communist, you may be a nihilist, you may claim you don't believe in anything. But no matter what you propose as your philosophy, you follow the same basic pattern of life that everybody else does. You want to get pleasure and avoid suffering. Even the cats and the dogs, even the amoebas who have no brains at all, even the microbes follow this program of trying to gain happiness and avoid suffering. Every living being. Dead matter doesn't know this, but every living conscious thing has this drive to be happy and avoid suffering. That is because our basic nature is ananda, pleasure seeking. That's the nature of the soul. And the pure soul, in his natural condition, in his proper position, is always experiencing happiness. That's what he's meant for. So that's what it means to be Kevalam, pure spirit. Prakritik Param. And the other side of that is that if we're pure spirit, then we're not matter. We are something superior, Param, superior to dead matter, to material nature. Here we are, just like a man. He's supposed to be the head of the household, but his wife is always bossing him around. Okay? Some men are in this condition. He doesn't realize. He thinks he's the boss, but the wife is actually controlling everything. So, in material life, that's our situation. We are actually superior to the material energy, but she's controlling us completely. Like a henpecked husband. We don't have to be. We are actually superior to matter. We don't have to let ourselves be controlled by this material energy. Nirantaram. Now this word is curious. It literally, it comes from the word antaram, which means interval, like the space between two things. I have, two books on the table. In between them, there is some space. That is antaram. If the books are next to each other exactly, that's nirantaram, no space. No space in between. So the word is usually used to mean when two things are touching each other, juxtaposed, in exact proximity. But here it's being used in a less usual sense. It means non-different. Don't just do it. Non-different. Abheda. This is the opinion of Srila Sridhar Swami in his commentary on this verse. That here we have to understand the word nirantanam not to mean touching, because it doesn't fit the context, it doesn't mean anything in the context of this verse. But it means that the soul is non-different from the Supreme. The Supreme is pure spirit. The individual soul is also pure spirit. Swayam Jyotihi. So that just literally means he has his own light. Self-illuminating. So what does that mean? There's some light bulb in the soul? No. Not like some firefly that makes his own light. We're not talking literally about light. We're talking about the illumination of consciousness. Consciousness is a power by which you can be aware of things. So we can say a computer, people talk about artificial intelligence. The computer is aware of something. It has information in it. But a computer is not Swayam Jyoti. It may have some artificial semblance of consciousness, but it's not aware of its own existence. But the living entity knows things out there, external things, and he knows himself also. That is not just Jyoti, but Swayam Jyoti. Aware, illuminating, not just like a lamp, illuminates the things in the room. And it also illuminates itself, but that's unconscious. On the realm of consciousness, the soul illuminates itself with awareness, and then also illuminates all the things and all the other selves that it perceives. That is the meaning of the word Swayam Jyoti. Animanam. So anima. Anu is actually the word. Very small. The word anu means atom, the smallest thing. So the living entity is described in the Upanishads. Keshagra shatabhagasya shatada kalpitasya cha. He can be understood, the dimension, the size of the soul can be understood if you take one blade of hair. You cannot even see the tip of your hair, it is so small. You need a microscope or a big magnifying glass to see the tip of one piece of hair. Take that tip of hair and cut it into 10,000 pieces. That is the size of the soul. Or that's just a way to imagine what the size of the soul is. It's actually smaller than that even. It's smaller than the atom. So what? Why do we need to be told that? What's the use of knowing that? Because that is the basis by which we can understand that we're not God. God is infinite, and we are infinitesimal, infinitely small. God is infinitely big. So we are both, we're nirantanam, we're non-different from God, but here's the point on which we're different. He's everything, and we're just a small piece, a very small particle. Akanditam. But he can't be cut into pieces. You cannot destroy the soul. You cannot divide him into pieces. You cannot separate his parts. There are inseparable qualities of the soul, especially his consciousness. The soul, spirit soul, is always conscious. You cannot remove the quality of consciousness from the soul. You can put him to sleep, you can drug him, but even in his sleep, even in his intoxication, the soul has his consciousness. It never goes away. Every night we experience deep sleep. There are two kinds of dreaming or sleeping condition: Supti and Sushupti. Dreaming consciousness and deep sleep in which we don't experience anything. Even the false ego is not functioning in deep sleep. And we experience that for some hours every night when we're sleeping. We don't experience anything. But when we wake up, we say to ourselves, oh, I slept very nicely, I don't remember anything. Which proves that you were there. The conscious self was there witnessing this empty experience. The soul's consciousness as the witness is always there, even in deep sleep. Akanditam. The soul, you cannot remove from the soul his qualities, you cannot divide him, you cannot destroy him. You cannot even destroy his basic qualities, such as consciousness. Okay, I'll look at the next verse.
Jnana vairagya yuktena bhakti yuktena chatmana paripashyat udasinam prakritim cha hatau jasam. In that position of self-realization, by practice of knowledge and renunciation in devotional service, one sees everything in the right perspective. He becomes indifferent to material existence, and the material influence acts less powerfully upon him.
So the previous verses, the two verses back describe the process very briefly. This verse and the verse before describe what you accomplish by the process. When the self reaps the benefits of understanding who he is, then he develops further. Just understanding theoretically that you're a pure spirit is good, but not everything. Jnana vairagya. To this knowledge must be added renunciation. If I just know theoretically I'm pure spirit, but I'm acting like a materialist, what's the use of that knowledge? I may be professor of theology in the university, but I have all bad material habits, and I don't believe in the scriptures that I'm studying. I'm an atheist. What's the use of an atheist theologist? And there are many of them nowadays. Theoretical knowledge, when it's not combined with actual detachment from material life, is incomplete. It's actually fruitless. You can read all the Shastras and write your commentaries, but if you don't believe it, then you get no benefit. And the proof of your conviction about the fact of your spiritual identity is that you're ready to give up material entanglement. You feel a sense of renunciation. So that vairagya has to be added to jnana, and it will come naturally if you're actually convinced, if you actually understand the theoretical understanding. Bhakti yuktena. And then, when jnana and vairagya become mature, you can begin to understand the highest science of bhakti yoga. The highest yoga. Here Kapila Devi is beginning to introduce the real culmination of knowledge.
Prabhupada translates it as, by practice of knowledge and renunciation in devotional service, bhakti,
the word actually comes from the verb budge, to share. It means to share. It's the reciprocation of sharing, loving exchange between the soul and his creator. But people misunderstand the word. They think it's some sort of sentiment, emotion. And that bhakti is for sentimental people, emotional people. They misuse the word, applying it to other objects than the Supreme. There is no such thing as deshbhakti. It's a misapplication of the word. You know, patriotism. If you want to be, you want bhakti, you must have bhakti for the Supreme Person. Gore, you're disturbing. Stay in one place. Bhakti yoga is devotion to the Supreme, not devotion to your country, not devotion to some demigod, but devotion to the Supreme Person. And Prabhupada translates it as devotional service, not just feeling, emotion, but service, doing something practically. That's bhakti. Actual reciprocation, not just expressing your love with great sentiment. What's the use of that? Show your love by doing something practical for the person you love. That is bhakti yoga. And Prabhupada's translation always is devotional service, not just feeling. Atmana paripashyat udasinam. Then you can observe yourself in an impartial spirit. You can see yourself as something separate than this material world. Prakritim chaha taujasam. And then the material energy has no choice but to begin to give up her hold on you. Maya is there to test us. That is her responsibility assigned to her by the Supreme Lord, to test us, to try to allure us with illusory attractions. But when a person doesn't respond, when he doesn't become attracted or repelled by the allurements of Maya, then she realizes this person is beyond my control. She offers her respects and goes away. That's success. Last verse of tonight, verse number 19. Nayujyamanaya bhaktiya bhagavat yakilat mani sadvishosti shivakpanta yoginam brahma siddhaye. Perfection in self-realization cannot be attained by any kind of yoga. Any kind of yogi, unless he engages in devotional service to the Supreme Personality of Godhead. For that is the only auspicious path. So Prabhupada is not simply exaggerating here, twisting the words to make it suit his purpose. This is what the Kapiladeva is saying. He's now shifting the topic. He's established in just six verses what is the basic idea of self-realization, what we designate as the Gyanakanda, the science of transcendental knowledge. And now we graduate to the postgraduate study of bhakti yoga in this verse. When devotional service is being practically engaged in, yujyamanaya, as passive present participle, when one is engaging in the practical process of serving the Supreme Lord, then he's achieved something that cannot be that no other yoga process can compare to. There is no other shivak panta. There is no comparable, equal, auspicious path in comparison to bhakti yoga. Most auspicious, and is the only effective means of gaining actual liberation. And that is specified very clearly here. Bhagavati akilatmani. This devotion must be directed to the proper object, to the personality of Godhead, Bhagavan. And maybe you think someone else is Bhagavan, anybody with lots of power or opulence, you may want to call him Bhagavan, some yogi, or even some politician, you may give him the name Bhagavan. But it says here, akilatmani. Real Bhagavan is the supreme soul of all beings. God, the personality of Godhead alone, fits that definition of who is actually Bhagavan. You may say we are all one, we are all God, but can you create the whole universe? Does everything emanate from you? If not, you're not God. Sadrishosti Shivak Panta. There is no equal, no auspicious path equal to the path of devotional service. Yogi Nam Brahmasidaye. Those who are serious yogis and want to achieve success, siddhi, on the spiritual path, they're advised to take this process of loving devotion to the Supreme Person. Now we've, in the 7 verses, gone over the whole path, beginning from elementary understanding of our spiritual identity to the highest understanding that we, our real success in life will come when we develop love of God and engage practically in the Supreme Lord's service. So tomorrow's verses will give Lord Kapiladeva's instructions to his mother on how one can begin that process of devotional service. Okay, so we'll stop here for tonight. We have a few minutes if anybody has any questions or comments. Okay, preferably something on the topic, but whatever you want to ask. Yes, Mother? Yes. Yes.
So when it comes only to the material world, it has got these 3 effects.
Yes, these are, yes.
If it leaves this and goes back immediately, it will be only in Puriya state.
Yes. In the spiritual world, there is no lower consciousness. It is all full awareness. We don't go to sleep in the spiritual world. We may have some pastime, some play. We may play and pretend to go to sleep. But we never, to go to sleep means to be covered by the mode of ignorance, to become forgetful of the world around us and of our own identity. So in spiritual life, that never occurs. In the spiritual world, there is no ignorance. In our embodied state in the material world, we are overcome by ignorance all the time. And every night, we're involuntarily forced to go to sleep. Our bodies and mind cannot function unless we sleep every night. We have to be plunged into ignorance just to work, to function. But there is no such necessity in the spiritual world. There's no reason, and there is no mode of ignorance. No forgetfulness in the spiritual world. So yes, the only state of consciousness is the pure spiritual state of consciousness in the spiritual world. No. A self-realized person realizes that turiya, that fourth condition of pure, full consciousness. In this world, a successful yogi can achieve that perfect consciousness. But Kapiladeva is going to make the point that only a devotee of the Lord can be such a perfect yogi. Then he can become Jivan Mukta. Liberated even while living in this material world and in his material body. And to be so liberated means to attain that pure, perfect consciousness, not covered by the modes of nature, not influenced by them. Okay? Yeah. Yes, Prabhu?
Many times in Prabhupada books, he gives explanation from Sridhar Swami. Like we don't have any literature speaking about the personality of Sridhar Swami. Can you just put something brief?
Who he is? Nobody knows for sure. There's different theories. We don't have historical record of who he actually was, even where he lived. Although Srila Jiva Goswami gives his opinion, we can accept that as authoritative, that he lived somewhere in the middle of India, which could mean anywhere from Uttar Pradesh, anywhere from Delhi down to Gwalior or so. That's what he considered, what in medieval times was considered Madhyadesh, the middle of the country. And according to Jiva Goswami, Sridhar Swami officially belonged to the Mayavad school, Shankaracharya Sampradaya. He was an initiated, he was a Mayavadi sannyasi. But he was actually a devotee. He wrote his commentary on Bhagavad Gita, on Vishnu Purana, and on Srimad Bhagavatam. He may have lived around 1350 AD, maybe. That's not certain. Just a guess. But we know from his writings that he was a pure devotee. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu affirms that. That Chaitanya Mahaprabhu says that I accept, he said his own opinion, I accept whatever Sridhar Swami says as authoritative. When Balabhadra wrote his commentary on Bhagavatam and showed it to Lord Chaitanya and said that I have corrected the mistakes of Sridhar Swami, Lord Chaitanya refused to look at that commentary. His only comment was that Swami nam mani jini tini ya veshogane mani. If a lady doesn't respect the Swami, because his husband is called Swami also, or here in Karnataka, any, you know, a beggar wants money from you, he'll call you Swami. Or a businessman wants your money, he'll call you Swami. Any respectable man is called Swami. But traditionally, a woman calls her husband Swami. So Mahaprabhu says, if a lady doesn't respect the Swami, she's a prostitute. And he was saying this to make Balabhadra embarrassed that he dared to criticize Sridhar Swami. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu will not hear such criticism. Jiva Goswami explains, though, that because Sridhar Swami was writing, part of his audience was the Mayavadis. He was a Mayavadi himself, officially. So he wanted to attract the attention of the Mayavadis and bring them to a proper understanding of Srimad Bhagavatam. So he enticed them with a few explanations that sounded like Mayavadi philosophy. Jiva Goswami's explanation is, this is like a fisherman putting bait on the hook to catch a fish. Badisha Amisha Nyaya. Like the logic of the piece of meat on the fish hook. So Sridhar Swami throws out a few tidbits of what sounds like Mayavadi philosophy to attract the Mayavadis. But actually there's nothing deviant in his commentaries. Pure Vaishnava explanation. And therefore in his six sandarbhas, his elaborate encyclopedic explanation of Srimad Bhagavatam, Srila Jiva Goswami quotes constantly long passages from the commentary on the Bhagavatam by Sridhar Swami, quotes him verbatim, uses him as a basic source of authority. And therefore, Prabhupada, because he based his purports largely on Jiva Goswami's sandarbhas, he's also quoting Sridhar Swami. And then Prabhupada also separately read that commentary of Sridhar Swami. Okay? Yeah. Anything else? Okay, so we can stop for tonight and we'll continue tomorrow. Thank you. All glories to Srila Prabhupada, Srimad Bhagavatam ki jai. Okay.